J.K. Rowling, Ronnie Barker, Fanny Crosby. Wonder what you think they had in common. First two are authors. Fanny Crosby wrote hymns. They all used lots of pen names. And Fanny Crosby had loads of pen names because she wrote so thousands of hymns, and she didn't want people to just think the hymns were good because her name was at the bottom of them. So she had many, many pen names. Did you know that she was the first woman ever to speak in the US Congress, and that she was a close friend of Abraham Lincoln? Neither did I until last Monday, but now I know. Well, one time she'd written a poem, but she had no music. She had no melody in her head to put it to. So she felt led, one of those things you don't hear so much of, I suppose, today. She felt led by God to send these words to a well-known composer called William Doane, D-O-A-N-E. He'd written many cantatas and songs and hymns and stuff like that. And as it so happened, in inverted commas, it just so happened that he was in this hotel room. He was desperately requiring a hymn. He had a melody, no words. It was writer's block. He had nothing to put there. And it just so happened there was a knock at the door, and there was the servant that Fanny Crosby had sent miles away to this man. And he opened the door, and the servant said, "Are you Mr. Doane?" "Yes." "Fanny Crosby says, I wonder, can you do anything with these words?" And immediately the words and the music fitted perfectly. God's timing is extraordinary. God is sovereign. I read this week Psalm 33. He foils the plans of nations. He thwarts the purposes of people. He's sovereign. But we are not fatalists, are we? When we are taught to pray by Jesus, we are taught to pray, "Thy will be done." We're not fatalists. We don't assume that everything that happens is God's first choice, do we? And my text is famous, isn't it? "For such a time as this, for such a time as this." And my title is, "It's Your Time." Book of Esther, written, I don't know, maybe 4 centuries before Jesus was born. Don't know. The theme, I suppose, if you had to say there's one theme, it is the Purim festival. The festival that the Jews kept to celebrate the fact that they weren't wiped out. To celebrate the preservation of the Jewish people. As you look through the Bible, there's always this notion of a remnant, isn't it? There's always this notion of a remnant. And here, even though Haman's a big shot, and even though this plan seems to be foolproof, the Lord somehow preserves the remnant. You'll remember in Exodus that the Hebrew slaves were delivered from Egypt. One devastating act of judgment of God, if you remember. And so the following morning, every firstborn son of Israel, who was still alive in the morning, knew there was only one reason he was still alive. A lamb had died in his place. And there's us, isn't it? There's our only hope, a Passover lamb, Jesus. And you remember also the Philistines and the Amalekites and the Assyrians and the Babylonians, all at various times tried to smash the Jews, tried to pummel them into submission, and failed. And there's another plot. And if you know anything about history, Adolf Hitler believed that he was completing this plot to wipe out the Jews that Haman hatches here. If you look at the book, there's plenty of banquets, feasts, but there's also fasting, particularly in this chapter here. And as you probably know as well, there's no real reference to the Almighty in the book. But if you read it with your eyes open, he's everywhere. He's all over it. So the setting is Persian Empire, Susa. Esther is there. As I mentioned, the king has got rid of Vashti, and there's a bit of a, I suppose, kind of regal version of Love Island, I suppose, like a beauty competition, and Esther wins it. The eponymous heroine is chosen as the new queen. The bad guy in the book is the evil schemer Haman. Maybe one of the first spin doctors, I wouldn't be surprised. His plan to exterminate the Jews. The good guy's Mordecai, who was previously to this chapter spotted that there was a conspiracy and already alerted the king. So he's a good guy. He's proven it in the past. He has a good track record. He's tipped off the king. And we pick up a story. Then Haman's plot has become known to Mordecai, who dons sackcloth, Jewish tradition, mourning. He calls on all the Jews to do the same because so much is at stake. I mentioned Pharaoh and Egypt. After the Passover, the following morning, inside every Egyptian home was a dead son. Inside, I suppose, every Israeli or Jewish home was a dead lamb. There's that picture all the time. We know all the way back in Genesis 3, God has promised, I'm going to send somebody. I'm going to send one. There's going to be this horrendous conflict between the one I'm sending, the seed of the woman, and the serpent. There's going to be a crushed head. There's going to be a bruised heel. It's going to be vicious. But in the words of William Williams' lovely hymn, though two had wounds, they conquered one. And Jesus was his name. Well, here's an attempt by the serpent through Haman to eradicate the Jews completely, to wipe them out. And we mentioned the logic fella this morning, Bertrand Russell. Logically, you can see if Haman manages to wipe out the Jews, there can be no Christ, there can be no Messiah, the son of David, because there wouldn't be any sons of David. So there's a lot at stake, humanly speaking. And our text is spoken by Mordecai to Esther, basically saying, you are the one in the exact position for such a time as this. This is what you've got to do, and you've got to do it. There's nobody else can do it. It's got to be you. Almighty God has put you here, Esther, for such a time as this. And you are where you are for such a time as this. And Esther's reply is, tell you what, you fast, and I will do it. I will. She doesn't say, oh, no, I'm out of my comfort zone here. I don't really feel comfortable doing this. She says, you fast, and I'll fast, and I will do it. I'll go in. You know the culture. Unless the golden scepter had been held out to her, she wasn't allowed to walk into the king's presence. If she just strolled in, she'd be executed. So, and she hasn't been there for a month. He's obviously getting fed up of her, or he's got a stream of others that he quite fancies. So she has to do something. She has to speak to the most powerful man in the empire, who hasn't been interested in her for 30 days, What a tough call. And here we are for such a time as this. You know, timing is vital. In music, timing is vital. In sport, timing is vital. What about in church? What about in the Christian life? You know, we got these pictures of the Christian life, and we the farmer, the soldier, the steward, you know, the athlete. For a farmer, time is important, isn't it? When to sow the seed, when to milk the cows. You know, farming is a relentless occupation, but time is important. The athlete, timing is important. Big youth meeting many years ago that I was at, they kept shouting from John 4, the fields are white unto harvest. Are they in Wales? I don't think so. I don't think they were white then. They're definitely not white now. 1 Chronicles 12, the men of Issachar come. They're a huge help to David. You know why? They understood the times. They knew what was required to be done. Why? They understood what was going on. They understood the times. Romans 13 urges us, understand the present time. Understand what's going on. Have your eyes open. Ask the Lord for light. Ask him to open your eyes so you know what's going on. So that you know your time, because it's your time. It's one thing to read about Fanny Crosby and so on, and revivals in the 19th century with D.L. Moody and Sankey, wonderful revivals. But we're not there. We don't live in America. It's not 1859. We're here. What's our time? What's your role in our time? What's your role in your time? Because God has placed you where you are for now. Again, let me repeat, we're not fatalistic. You know, Jonah on the run from God. It's just the right time for Jonah. There's a ship. It's going exactly the opposite direction than what he needs to go, but he wants to go there because he didn't want to go God's way. So we're not fatalistic. We don't just say, well, everything that happens that we are, that must be God's first choice. That's not so. Here you are at this time. There's a man I was talking to a few years ago now, I said, how are you doing spiritually? Oh, remember that day in 1993? I do. Oh, wasn't it wonderful? It was. I said, but we're not in 1993 now. What's happening now? Well, he said, you remember that? Yeah, I remember the day. It was wonderful. Best day of my life. But we're not there now. What's happening now? See, we can live in nostalgia. We can live in a nostalgia. Then we weren't even there. We can read about revivals and so on and say, wasn't that wonderful? The Isle of Lewis in 49, you know, 1904 in Wales, 1859, you know, in Ireland and Wales and so on. We can live in the past. But what's happening now is the thing. Where are you? You're here now. In this little fellowship, at this particular moment, does God want you here? If he does, what does he want you here for? What is your role here? When I first came here, people helpfully, in inverted commas, said, oh, I remember, you know, did we have a Sunday school? Maybe one, was it, occasionally? Remember people helpfully saying to me, oh, I remember when we had 100 in the Sunday school. Well, that's a big help, isn't it? Now I've just come and we got virtually nobody. But I had two observations on that. My first question to you, you were telling me that you had over 100 in the Sunday school. Was there more life then? Or just more people? And second, my observation, what about now? We're here now. In the earliest days of my Christian life, there was a lot of prophecy, mostly predictive, guessing really, and almost entirely wrong. But occasionally there was the other kind of prophetic word, somebody speaking just the right phrase or just the right verse into the situation, and you knew, wow, God has spoken for such a time as this. Mordecai cared. Esther, her life was on the line. It was literally on the line. She's taking a risk. And if I perish, I perish. She's taking a big chance here. It was a real possibility. All because her relative, Mordecai, has said to her, for such a time as this, I'm taking a stand. You must take a stand. Because Haman is about to eradicate the chosen people of God. Well, there we are. Here you are. Here I am. Our land is undoubtedly becoming a moral cesspit. We're going down the drain rapidly. Even I can see in the last 40 years, there are things happening now which would never have happened then. We are seeing things on the TV now that would never have been tolerated then. Why? In 1959, Lloyd-Jones, preaching in London on the anniversary of the revival, said there is no hope for spiritual growth until the church takes responsibility for the state of the nation. Now, we don't think like that even in the church anymore. We say, oh, isn't it awful what's happening there? But here's Lloyd-Jones saying, yes, it's awful, and it's our responsibility to pray and worship and preach, and then they'll be changed, rather than just say, oh, isn't it awful? Well, it is awful. It's always been awful. The world's always been a mucky place. Romans 13, understanding the present time. You are time. Here you are. Here I am. Romans 13 goes on. Wake up from your slumber. Now, when you've been dozing nicely, it's not very pleasant when somebody wakes you up, is it? You've been dozing? Easy to doze in church, isn't it? Somebody said, church in our day is sleeping with the light on. It takes effort. I can't sleep easily with the light full on, can you? But we're managing it somehow, spiritually, aren't we? A former head of a missionary organization told me recently that we now are in extreme measures, or we ought to be. A friend of mine has just gone to be a governor of a school, poor dad. And the first meeting, he finds out that the school is a failing school, and he said, extreme measures. Well, what this guy from the retired guy from the missionary organization was saying, this is our situation. We should be ringing the alarm bell. We should be pulling the communication cord. We should be sounding the hooter to say, something awful is happening on our watch. What are we going to do about it? What are we to do? Well, we're to be his witnesses. We're to be his signposts, aren't we? Signposts are very simple, and there you need two things: clear words and point in the right direction. That's all you need on a signpost. Clear words, point in the right direction. Are you clear when you talk to people? Do you talk to people about Jesus? Are you clear? Are you pointing in the right direction, or do they just see hypocrisy written all over you? You know, we were in a large funeral this week. Lovely testimonies, rousing singing, great preaching. I couldn't help thinking, but this is easy in here, isn't it? You know, there was packed, hundreds of professing Christians there all singing and saying amen, whatever. But what are we like when we get outside in the world? Anybody can parrot spiritual cliches and phrases when they're surrounded by people who are going to say amen, isn't it? But what's it like? What are you like out there for such a time as this? Wherever you go, the fields are not white in Wales. The bulk of Christians, frankly, don't seem to care. Why not? It does seem increasingly as if the church has become a kind of me club. I remember, when I was a very young Christian reading George Verwer, OM, founder, that phrase that I heard hundreds of times afterwards, the first time I'd heard it, get out of your comfort zone. Do you get out of your comfort zone? My wife read a cartoon to me this week. I think it's very powerful. Garfield, the cartoon, where somebody in the cartoon is asking, what's wrong with the world? And then the answer, it doesn't do enough for me. That's powerful. Because I just think, there's the church. If people are not pampered in their church, if they don't feel appreciated, encouraged, welcome, or whatever it is, well, they go somewhere else. You know, so many Christians are like that. It's about me. We sang this morning, I just pointed it out. You know, it's all about you. But is it all about him? There's a meeting I went to 15 years ago in the City Temple for church leaders. And it was awful. He was a brilliant speaker. I mean, but what he said was, you know, church leader, do you feel unappreciated? Are you not getting the thanks you deserve? I felt like screaming, get a life, man. What's the matter with you? What planet are you from? Grow up. It was like self-esteem sessions, man. I feel sorry for any young pastor who goes into his first pastorate and realizes now he's got to wean all these people off themselves. And they don't want to be weaned off themselves onto Christ. They've been enjoying themselves, pampering themselves. This obsession with ourselves. It's not about you. Jesus, it's all about me. Oh, no, I can't sing that. And I wouldn't dare say it, but that's the reality, isn't it? How many officers over the years? We can't get enough officers for camps, you know. How many was we done? Loads of camps. 20, I don't know how many camps we did all together. How many times did an officer come? And they'd come, obviously, for all the wrong reasons. They'd come to serve, but not to serve God. They had all sorts of, it was obvious once you started talking to them, they had all sorts of things listed on their agenda why they'd come. But officially, of course, they wanted to serve Jesus Christ. It's a battle, isn't it? It's a battle. If you want to be a farmer, you've got to fight to be a farmer. If you want to be a soldier, you've got to fight to be a soldier. You want to be a good steward of your money or whatever, you've got to fight to be a good steward. And fighting, you need weapons. Have you got spiritual weapons? Do you pick them up? Do you even know what they are or where they are? You know, 10 years ago, the Atheistic Society said that the opposition has vanished. The opposition is us. The opposition has vanished. Once they had radical messages about heaven and hell. Now it's cheer me up religion. Are they right? Yeah. Do you care? I don't know. Some years ago, there was a Pentecostal pastor. He said, nothing's happening in our church. I'm depressed. Let's have a radical overhaul of church. We'll have cell groups. We'll all get to know each other and spend time in each other's company socially. We'll have coffee tables out for the services and make everybody more chilled and relaxed and whatever. And more people come. Problem is, still nothing's happening. You're doing all these things, but still nothing's happening spiritually. You know, I know I've shared this before. A long time ago, I went to a man, a well-known preacher, and sat him down because he wasn't happy. I had tried to give advice about his sermons. And in the end, I just said to him, I tell you what then, I promise I'll never comment on your sermons again. And he was so thrilled that he hugged me. So where are we then? What's the point then? Can you see how bad that is? Can you? You may not be a preacher, but can you see how bad that is? When the pastor said to me this week, you know, the 2 Timothy, you know, people will become in terrible times, people will become lovers of themselves. And he was saying, it's impossible to have a spiritual conversation with anybody in my church. And does everybody go home feeling the same, saying, oh, Lord, we need to fast and pray because it's impossible? No, they don't. They just go home. We see people drowning spiritually in church. We see it. You may be sitting next to somebody now who's drowning, or maybe drowning yourself. Or you may be sitting next to somebody who's spiritually drowning, and we just close our eyes and try not to think about it. Let them drown. I spoke to a lady about 5 years ago after this morning service. I'd known her, but I knew who she was on and off for years. And she was very distressed because she didn't know where she stood. She was a professing Christian of probably 15 years standing, I suppose. But that morning she didn't know where she stood. And I spoke to her at length and explained to her what it was all about. And she was very upset, but increasingly she was convinced that she wasn't saved. And the more she spoke, the more I was thinking she's probably right. Sometime after, she left the church, left her family as well, as it happened, caused mayhem. Then at a funeral recently, I saw her. And I was thinking, now then, I haven't seen her since. She's in church today. Will she ever be in church again? Don't know. I watched her. Is she singing any of the songs, the hymns? No. Does she seem to be listening? No, though she did mouth one or two lines from the final hymn. I thought, well, I've got to try and speak to her. Why? Is anybody else going to speak to her? I don't know. Or are they just going to put their arm around her when she's upset? Is anybody going to talk to her about her soul? I don't know. But here I am for such a time as this. I know she's needy. I know she's probably lost. She's on her way to hell, almost certainly. I'm here. I know it. I've got to speak to her then. Are there other people who know it? I don't know. I remember a film one time. Jim is going to do something and somebody says to him, Jim, if you do that, it'll cause massive problems. Why are you going to do it? And Jim says, because it's the right thing to do. And here we are. We're Christians. We care about what's the right thing to do. Don't we? I remember I was a very young Christian. We had a heads of department meeting in the school. We had headmaster chairing it. And there was some issue. I can't remember what it was. But I remember just opposing it. And eventually somebody from over there shouted across and said, excuse me, Alan, how does this affect you? I said, it doesn't affect me at all. And the headmaster said, well, if it doesn't affect you, why are you opposing it? I said, because it's wrong. And there was silence. I mean, because they didn't understand, you see. Well, it doesn't affect you, but you care. Why do you care? Because it's wrong. Here we are. We're Christians, aren't we? Do we care about truth? Jesus does. Are there some things that are right? Yes. Are there some things that are wrong? Yes. So here you are in your particular situation. You'll meet all sorts of people I'll never meet. You live before the gaze of folks I'll never encounter. And you will be a witness, for good or bad, for such a time as this? Are you Esther? Are you one of those people fasting and praying for Esther? Are you Mordecai, who can't actually do anything, but tells the one person who can and fasts and prays? Or are you brilliantly disguised Haman, actually opposing because of your behavior, because of how you live your life? Who are you? There's little Esther in the corner there. When she says, "Dad," first, there'd be a great excitement. When she starts to walk, I started to walk once, everybody was excited. I've carried on walking for almost 67 years, nobody cares. But spiritually, if you carry on walking, Jesus cares, loves it. He's excited, he never loses his excitement, his thrill, when he sees his children, just like the Apostle John, walking in the light. Psalm 34, taste and see that the Lord is good. Have you tasted? You'd all say, "Oh, yes, yes." So have you tasted? You said, "Yeah, I've tasted that. I don't want to try that again." When Jesus says, "You walk with me now," say, "Yeah, I've done that. I walked with it before." Is that what you're saying? Yes, Lord, I've tasted, but I really can't be bothered to carry on walking with you. I know officially I love you, but what are you saying? What are you saying tonight? See, spiritually tonight, if you want to go on, he's saying, "Go on, I'm with you. Go on, go on. Don't be afraid of their faces. Fear not, I've redeemed you. You are mine. You were born in Zion." If you want to go on, that's what he's saying. Now, what about you at this very moment? Here we are at 10 to 7 on a Sunday night in Town Hill. What about you for such a time as this? I remember a man telling me years ago, he'd been out Sunday afternoon. He was planning to go to his own church in the night. He came home, there was a message on his answer phone. Remember answer phones? Message on his answer phone saying, "We haven't got a preacher tonight. I don't know, can you find your old sermon and come and do something?" Well, he'd only preached once or twice, so he rummaged through his old notes and he found this sermon. He said to himself, "I can hardly read it, it's faded." And then he started to think, "Yeah, it's not just the sermon that's faded, my testimony is faded." Is yours faded? You got an up-to-date testimony? Your witness up to date? For such a time as this. Oh, you're sitting there thinking, "Oh yeah, I'd love to be the one to go on, but you know, is anybody else interested? I'd love to be the one to talk about spiritual things, but is anybody else? I'd love to be the one to start praying, fasting, to take God more seriously, but is anybody else?" Or are you just going to say, "I'm going to sing to the Lord, he's been good to me. He's been good to me, even if nobody else is interested. Lord, I'm interested. As for me, I'm interested. I'll follow you. I'm going to say one thing I want. This is what I'm after, Lord. I want to live near you. I want to dwell in your house. I want to walk with you. And I want to know the thrill of gazing upon the presence of God." You interested tonight? For such a time as this. You may want to talk to somebody afterwards, just to enthuse them, or to try and be enthused. Or you may just want to think on your own and pray and ask and analyze, what are you at the moment? Who are you?